Good morning and happy Sunday and welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway. And you know, last week I said I didn't just want my show to be entertaining, but I wanted it to be informative, inspirational, and motivational. And today is one of those informative Sundays because I've got a guest here that's going to talk about something that has not only affected my family, but I've also been told recently that it's affecting one of my closest friends. And I'm ashamed almost that I haven't spoken about this sooner. But I have a guest, Dr. Derek M. Fine, who is a kidney and nephrology specialist at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and he's going to break down for us why blacks are more susceptible to kidney disease and failure than any other race in the country. I've also got the Petty here today, and he's going to break down the NFL playoff picture for us, the games that are left, and also give us some new information on Lamar Jackson and the Ravens, which we all want to know what's going on with that situation. Hopefully something better than what we talked about last week. And of course, you've got me. I'm going to give you some news and current events from the past week, and I love doing that the most. So I hope you're feeling great, because I'm feeling great. I've got lots to say, so let's get right to it. Well, here we go again. It appears that all six defense attorneys representing Marilyn Mosby have asked to be removed from her case. Mosby's lead attorney, A. Scott Bolden, and three others from his firm, Rizwan Qureshi, Kelly Miller, and Anthony Todd, all of Reed Smith LLP, said that an order from U.S. District Attorney Judge Lydia K. Grigsby that found Bolden violated the Maryland rules governing attorney conduct created a conflict of interest for them. According to the Baltimore Sun, at a pretrial hearing Tuesday, Grigsby ordered Bolden to explain in writing by the 31st of this month why she should not hold him in criminal contempt of court for using profanity to criticize the court, why he divulged confidential juror information in a legal motion, and why he filed the same motion without a Maryland's lawyer's signature. Now, Bolden is actually out of D.C., and he does not have a license to practice law here in the state of Maryland, so anything that he files with the court, he needs to co-file, and all papers need to be signed with someone who is licensed here in the state of Maryland, and apparently, he did not do that. Now, in addition to those four, attorneys Lucius Outlaw and Gary Proctor, who joined the defense team over the summer, also asked Grigsby for permission to back out of the case. The filing said Outlaw and Proctor, who each operate their own law practices, joined Mosby's defense team in support roles and are not able to accommodate being lead defense lawyers in the case. In a filing, Mosby has consented to the withdrawing of these six attorneys from her defense, but Judge Grigsby has to approve the lawyer's request to withdraw from the case. Now, the fact that these six attorneys want to leave Marilyn Mosby does not necessarily mean that they find her case indefensible or impossible to win. But, you know, she's in a lot of hot water. The government has said that they have built an incredibly strong case against her. They've had a lot of time to do it. They brought in witnesses from basically everywhere. They have a trail of paperwork that she's left behind. And so, you know, it doesn't look good. So right now, Judge Grigsby has postponed this trial to now March 27th, which happens to be my birthday. But because it looks like Marilyn Mosby is going to have to find a new defense team for her perjury and fraud charges, which is no small task for any defense team at this point in the game, that trial date that is set for March 27th will more than likely be pushed back again. Now, there is a buzz that A. Scott Bolden knew exactly what he was doing when he stood on the courthouse steps talking to media using profanity about a case that he should not have been speaking about, and that he also filed papers unlicensed so that this case would continue to be delayed. Now, I don't know if I buy that. That's a huge risk. But if he did, and this case is continuing to be delayed because he did that intentionally, then what does that say about them feeling that they could win this case? And in other local news in the state of Maryland of the most positive kind.
Place your left hand on the Bible, raise your right hand, and repeat after me. I, Wesley Watende Omari Moore.
I, Wesley Watende Omari Moore.
Do swear.
Do swear.
That I will support the Constitution.
That I will support the Constitution.
Of the United States.
Of the United States.
And that I will be faithful.
And that I will be faithful.
And bear true allegiance.
And bear true allegiance.
To the state of Maryland.
To the state of Maryland.
And support the Constitution.
And support the Constitution.
And laws thereof.
And laws thereof.
And that I will.
And that I will.
To the best of my skill and judgment.
To the best of my skill and judgment.
Diligently and faithfully.
Diligently and faithfully.
Without partiality or prejudice.
Without partiality or prejudice.
Execute the office.
Execute the office.
Of Governor of Maryland.
As Governor of Maryland.
Congratulations, Governor Moore.
That's right, it's official. On Wednesday, Wes Moore, the very first black governor of Maryland, was sworn into office, surrounded by family and friends and in attendance constituents of the state of Maryland. And one of those friends, and who supported him throughout his entire campaign financially and morally, is Oprah Winfrey. Now, Oprah Winfrey has gone on record and continues to say that she considers Baltimore, Maryland, the place where she cut her teeth in media. So she has not held back at all in being boisterous in her support and her desire for Wes Moore to be the next governor of Maryland. And she was right there in attendance as he was being sworn in. Now, obviously, I'm biased here at 1500 Radio because Wes Moore granted me an interview with him before he was elected while he was campaigning at a very busy time. So I really appreciated that. And he's agreed to come back onto the show as the governor of Maryland at a later date. So yeah, I'm very excited and I'm very happy that he is now the governor of Maryland. And of course, it's historic. But more than that, I just think he'll be a great man for the job. Also in the news, actually big in the news, is that famed actor Alec Baldwin will be charged with 2 counts of involuntary manslaughter for the 2021 fatal shooting on the New Mexico set of the film Rust. Santa Fe, Mexico's first judicial district attorney, Mary Carmack L. Tweez, and Special Prosecutor Andrea Reeb announced their decision on Thursday in a written statement shared with the media. It read, "After a thorough review of the evidence and the laws of the state of New Mexico, I have determined that there is sufficient evidence to file criminal charges against Alec Baldwin and other members of the Rust film crew," Carmack L. Tweez said in a statement. "On my watch, no one is above the law, and everyone deserves justice." Now, for those of you who are not familiar with this situation, Alec Baldwin is an actor, a famed actor, who was scheduled to star in a Western. The film was called Rust. In this scene, he is supposed to aim and fire a weapon at another actor. That's what people do in Westerns. They shoot each other on the screen, right? Well, the prop gun that he had a live round in the chamber. And so when he raised the gun and pulled the trigger, it killed a young lady named Helena Hutchins right there on the spot. 42-year-old Hutchins was not even an actress. She was on the set filming as a cinematographer when Alec Baldwin, who was practicing with his Colt 45, pulled the trigger on what he thought was his prop gun, and the live round that was in the chamber struck her and killed her. Now, another person was actually hurt, director Joel Souza, during the shooting. This is the thing that baffles me. Most actors, I don't know of any actors that are responsible for the props. There are people who are paid to ensure that these props are safe. They had an armorer on set who, by the way, is also charged with second-degree manslaughter. They have directors on the set. They have safety crews on the set. All of these people are to ensure that when you hand an actor a prop gun, that it's a prop gun. It is not his responsibility to check and make sure the gun is safe. His responsibility is to know his lines and to make the scene dramatically realistic. Now, most actors finish their lines, their scene cut, they go back to their trailer until they're needed again. The problem with Alec Baldwin and what makes this legally sticky for him is that he was not just an actor on the set, he was also a co-producer. But I don't know, nor does anyone else at this point know, what the legal ramifications are for him in the situation being a co-producer. Does that mean that he has some responsibility in making sure that the prop gun is safe? If that is in fact the case, then why aren't all of the producers being charged with manslaughter? It just doesn't make any sense to me. It sounds to me that the district attorney and the special prosecutor in Santa Fe, Mexico, have been presented an opportunity, wrong or right, where they can make a bigger name for themselves. That's what it sounds like to me. It happens often, and this doesn't sound like it's any different. Listen, I'm not a fan of Alec Baldwin. In fact, I think it's stupid for him to have said initially that he never pulled the trigger, and now the FBI is saying what their ballistics is telling them is that there's no way this gun could have been fired without pulling the trigger. That's a whole nother thing. But whether he pulled the trigger or not, the fact that they put a loaded gun in his hand that was supposed to be a prop gun, I don't think is his responsibility. I just don't know how you make that the actor's responsibility. His job is to pull the trigger at some point. So for him to have lied and said he didn't pull it, I mean, that's immaterial to me because his job is to pull it. Whether they say action or not, there should not have been a live round in that chamber. And it is not his job to make sure that that gun is safe. That goes well beyond his job description. And the last story I want to get to today before I start with my guest is a story about how far we've come in the wrong direction with our political stances, in particular ones that relate to religion. I know the golden rule in the Constitution is that religion and politics stay separate from each other, but we all know that that's not the case, in particular in the Republican Party. And so this is the story I want to read to you. According to Raw Story, the news organization, at the Georgia March for Life gathering on Friday, Georgia Director for the National Federation of Republican Assemblies, Nathaniel Darnell, thanked God in a public prayer for the death of Georgia State House Speaker David Ralston, calling the late lawmaker an obstacle to passing more restrictive abortion bans. Ralston, a Republican himself, passed away after an extended illness at the age of 68 in November, just 2 weeks after announcing he would be stepping down due to health issues. He led the Georgia House of Representatives for about 13 years. Now, in the prayer, Darnell said, and I quote, "Lord, may you please confront those legislators who might seek to be an obstacle to these efforts. We thank you for how you have relieved us from one legislator, a speaker who made himself an obstacle. And we pray that, Father, you would help other legislators to serve you in fear and to take warning." Now, Georgia has already passed a measure that functionally bans nearly all abortions. It prohibits any abortion past 6 weeks before most women even know that they're pregnant. And it only allows exceptions past that 6 week period for rape, incest, a lethal birth defect, or a life-threatening pregnancy complication. But anti-abortion hardliners want Georgia law to go even further. And I guess they're so desperate for it that these quote-unquote pro-life people will pray to God for the deaths and celebrate the deaths of those persons that they feel get in the way of their purpose. Okay, I want to shift gears here and I want to talk about kidney failure and kidney disease. Now, I had an aunt that recently passed away from complications of kidney failure. She was waiting for a transplant, a kidney donor, and she died before she was able to get one. And then on top of that, I spoke to a lifelong friend of mine recently. And when I say lifelong friend, we've been friends since we were like 4 or 5 years old. And he told me that he's having problems with his kidneys. So I thought to myself, like, what the hell is going on with kidneys? I've never really paid attention to it. I know of people who have been on dialysis, but you know, I wasn't. So selfishly, I never really paid attention to it. So then I started doing some research. And what I found was pretty astounding. Like, blacks suffer kidney disease at the rate 3 times higher than anybody else in the country. So, you know, to me being who I am, I've got to research that and find out why. The only way that I can read for forever and I can hear this and I can hear that, or I can talk to a kidney specialist, a nephrologist, and I happen to know one. His name is Dr. Derek M. Fine, and he is a kidney specialist, a nephrologist, and professor of medicine, and just an overall awesome human being who happens to work where I was born, and that's at Johns Hopkins Hospital. So help me welcome Dr. Derek Fine to On the Weekend Edition. All right, Dr. Fine, good morning. Thank you so much for joining me today on the show. I'm really, really appreciative of you being here today. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you so much for having me. I look forward to our conversation.
My pleasure, my pleasure. I got to tell you, one of the reasons I'm so happy that you're here today is because, you know, my audience is predominantly black. And we hear a lot of things in reference to, in particular, kidney failure. I just lost an aunt a few months ago to complications of kidney failure. And I know a lot of my listeners have friends, family, loved ones who are struggling with kidney disease. And I just, you know, I needed someone's professional opinion about what's going on. Is there any theory, really, to predisposition due to heredity about kidney disease, or is it truly just dietary?
Turns out in the last 10, sort of 15 years, there have been a lot of discoveries regarding the genetics behind kidney disease. And we're finding more and more that there are genetic underpinnings to kidney disease, and particularly in African Americans. There was a gene discovered probably about 15 years ago was the first sort of paper that was published regarding this gene, and when they sort of localized it more specifically, it was probably about 13, 14 years ago, there's a gene called APOL1 that has small changes in it. It's not like a mutation, but there's a little bit of a difference in this particular gene. We don't actually know exactly what the protein is doing that's made by this gene. Uh-huh. But these changes predispose to kidney disease. And the origin of that gene is actually in West Africa. So the populations in West Africa, it came over, obviously, with immigrant slaves, most likely, a long time ago. And that's where the risk is from. So there is clearly a genetic predisposition. We can talk more about that gene because, you know, there are things we can do, and we're learning a lot more about it. I think there's also some of it is, or a lot of it is still diet, in the sense that diabetes is still the most common cause of kidney disease.
Right.
And that's closely related to obesity. There is probably more diabetes in the African American community, at least compared with Caucasians. I think Latinos also suffer a very high prevalence of diabetes, and then hypertension is more common, and in part related to that gene, but also I think there's just more hypertension in general. Again, obesity is a big part of all of this. So a big part is this genetic predisposition.
Okay.
That was a discovery. It really increases the rates in those who carry these genes, or they actually have both sort of the chromosomes have sort of one from the mom, one from the dad, you know, and you have to have one from each parent for that risk to be there. And it's about 13% of the African American population carries these two genes and are considered at risk for kidney disease just based on genetics without any other factor. I do think that on top of this is sort of fairly high rates of diabetes, hypertension, and then I think access to healthcare, we can't discount that as well, in some or many parts of the country where there's probably not the same access to good healthcare, such as blood pressure control, diabetes control. So when you have the diseases, it's not being treated as effectively.
Understood. Now, I can't help but to hear, and I'm sure my listeners do too, hear an accent from you. Now, you were born and raised in South Africa, is that correct?
That's correct, in Johannesburg.
Oh, okay. So, growing up as a young boy and a teen, I guess before you came to the States to study, you experienced apartheid firsthand, correct?
I did. I probably was not fully aware of everything as being a young person. I left when I was 19. I would say by the time I left, I was always aware of what was going on, but I think looking back, I probably knew less than I should have.
Okay. Was there any motivation to study medicine based on what you saw when you were a youngster, or is that just something that was in the family, the medical background?
I think the medical background was a big part in my family.
Okay.
My grandparents, which is uncommon back then, but my grandparents, my mom's parents were both physicians. Both of them worked at a hospital in Soweto called Baragwanath Hospital, and I think really served the community. And we grew up with that, knowing that they were doing things for the community that many others weren't. But whether that, I think they inspired me, but I think just through their general personalities and the type of people they were, I can't say whether apartheid made a difference, but it was so part of how you grew up.
Right.
In South Africa, it has influence, but I can't pinpoint and say this is an experience I had that pushed me into medicine because of that.
When you left South Africa, you came directly here to study medicine? Was that the deal?
I actually did 2 years of medical school in South Africa, in Johannesburg, and then I came out to the States. I had family in Miami and sort of completed college there before coming to Johns Hopkins for medical school.
The inequities in medicine between African Americans and Caucasian, is it very apparent to you here?
So, you know, I'm not going to claim to be an expert on the data. Okay. In any way, but I will talk from my personal experience, and yeah, I obviously know I have some very prominent colleagues who this is what they study, what they talk about. They do disparities research, and I obviously know some of the things they do. Sorry, long-winded answer.
No, it's okay.
but you know, it's not just healthcare, right? It's society. So I'll give you a small example where it comes to my attention every day, okay, is my patients who are on dialysis, who live in the inner city near Johns Hopkins, very few of them have cars, right?
Okay.
And so to get to dialysis, you have to rely on someone else to get to dialysis. The systems are not well set up. You know, in order to make your travel arrangements, you know, you need to make calls, you need to be accessible. When the weather is bad, it's hard to get to dialysis sometimes. So sometimes they arrive late. Sometimes transport doesn't show up on a bad weather day. That may affect the transport. And then they don't get the same care because, you know, someone who owns a car, who has access to good transport can drive to the dialysis center.
Right.
Or if the dive center closes, they'll drive to another dive center, and then it's just, okay, I'm going to drive somewhere else. So I know it's a very small thing, but I think it's representative of so many other things where healthcare is impacted, right? So it's where you buy your food, right? In my dialysis center, my patients need to follow certain diets. And it's very hard to, you know, eat foods without phosphate if you don't have access to fresh fruit and vegetables or to healthy food. You know, if you're eating snacks and you're eating food from the, you know, corner concession, you're going to be eating foods that are really going to affect your labs and your health. And so that is huge in this, is just, you know, food deserts. And you've probably spoken about that before.
I have actually.
But food deserts impact kidney disease significantly, and maybe more than many other diseases, because diet may be so important in people who have kidney disease. So there's, it's not just the healthcare. I think that a patient who comes to me, I would hope wherever they're from, gets as good care whether they live near Johns Hopkins or they're driving in from Pennsylvania, I can provide them the same care. But then what happens outside of the clinic when it comes to getting a medication that has a high copay, or they have to pay a huge amount of money for insulin? And you know, we hear this on the news all the time. Right? Oh,
right.
Patient has to not pay their mortgage in order to get the insulin, or vice versa. And it's so real.
Yeah.
These are real issues.
It's very odd, because you hear a lot about the violence in the inner city, in particular Baltimore. What you don't hear about are the food deserts. There's carbs all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, there's sugary drinks all over the place. There's liquor stores everywhere. But you don't hear anything about fruits and vegetables. You know, when I was a kid, in order to get our fruits and vegetables, there used to be a guy that used to come by with a wagon, you know, that would sell them off of a wagon. But you don't even have that anymore. So I'm just trying to figure out. You know,
I actually have a patient who was, I think they called him Arabers. Or,
yeah, there you go. That's exactly right.
And he told me he used to go down the street with his card and sell fruit and vegetables, and he showed me what he would shout out.
Yeah.
He would go down the street, and people would come out of their houses and buy food from him.
That's exactly right. Well, you don't have that anymore. And so, but you still have the same lack of transportation, you know what I mean? And you still have the need to get those things, and it's not happening. So does the hospital, or has anyone, you know, is there anyone in a position in the hospital to have that kind of clout to talk to the governor or the mayor to set up a program that could introduce that to the inner city?
Yes. You know, there's a lot of effort. I don't want to downplay the effort, because so I have a colleague, Dr. Deirdre Cruz. I mean, she's really a leader. First, she's going to be the president of the American Society of Nephrology.
Oh, okay.
So one of the top positions in our national society, who, that's what her research is. She has a study where she provides fruit and vegetables to one group, and the other group is, you know, they get other things. But to show that these type of things have impact, and there is a lot of lobbying, discussions. They're out there. People are out there. And it's just a battle. And I believe they've had impact, and things are better than they were. But I think everyone acknowledges that we're far from where we need to be.
Exactly.
But yeah, I think that our institution is aware of the community that surrounds it, and is working hard with the community, at least what I see. But, you know, I think there's no lack of trying, but there's a long way to go. We all know that we haven't got to the goals we need to, but there are people who are working on it, who care, who are, you know, very interested in the community and in making life and healthcare better. So I don't think anyone's sweeping it under the carpet.
No,
it's
just not at the forefront.
There are a lot of things that, you know, that go into it, and it's sometimes harder to do that than to give someone a pill, right?
Right. I understand. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
What do you think are, there are many symptoms, I would assume, but what are some of the symptoms that we can look for in ourselves and our loved ones and our family that would hint towards kidney failure or kidney disease?
Yeah. So this is a brilliant question, and the reason is because there usually aren't symptoms early.
Okay.
And so it's a silent disease until it's not silent anymore, at which point you've probably got much more significant damage than had one been monitoring through blood tests and other sort of monitoring of blood pressure type things, because most patients really don't have any symptoms if they have kidney disease. Now, if you have a disease that is associated with kidney disease, so for example, if someone has lupus, which is also more prevalent in African Americans and is frequently associated with kidney disease, they'll manifest because they have lupus symptoms. They'll have their joint pains or their fevers or their rashes. And then you'll look at their kidney function and be like, oh, you've also got kidney disease, and it has its, there you have very specific therapy for kidney disease. But in the average person who's walking around with hypertension, diabetes, maybe other causes of kidney disease, like these genetic diseases, they don't have symptoms till things are fairly advanced. And at that point, it's much, much harder to manage.
You know, I noticed that on the TV, you can't really turn on the TV without seeing commercials now for HIV medication and drugs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's given a false sense of security, in particular in the African American community, that if I get it, HIV, I can get rid of it through these drugs, right? I understand that HIV is also a contributor to kidney disease. Is that correct? Or can be. Do you see a lot of that, or the numbers for HIV, are they really going down, or have they spiked, or are they where they've always been? What do you see?
So I actually have a HIV clinic. So we have an HIV clinic, and I have a kidney clinic within the HIV clinic.
Okay.
Where I see only HIV patients. So it's been an area of interest of mine for, you know, 20 years. The statistics are showing that there is now a slight decrease in new cases. I think I saw that recently. You know, but we're still seeing new infections. Fortunately, in those who take medications, they're unlikely to transmit HIV if their viral load is controlled.
Okay.
And I think that's where you start to see the reduction. And then there also are people who take pre-exposure prophylaxis, where they are high risk for contracting HIV and they take medications, and that also reduces transmission. But you're right, I think that it is a very treatable disease now. And I would say that my average patient in my HIV clinic has very well controlled HIV. And they basically have the type of kidney diseases that everyone else has.
Okay.
You know, whether it's diabetes, hypertension, the HIV specific kidney diseases we see much, much less now because the virus is so well treated. But there is a little bit of a false sense of security in that if you do get it these days and you get started on antiretrovirals early, you know, the life expectancy is probably close to normal now.
Okay. Well, that's good.
And so, you know, it doesn't mean you want to get it. The drugs are still have toxicities, much less than they used to, though. And, you know, it's pretty easy to treat these days, but it is a chronic disease. And you wouldn't want people to sort of say, oh, it's okay if I get it. But if you do get it or you have it, there's no reason now not to expect normal life expectancy. And what we're seeing is all the diseases that non-HIV patients get are the same ones we're seeing in HIV, right?
Okay.
They get cancer and they get diabetes and hypertension, because the HIV is in the background now.
Gotcha. Well, that's really good news. Really good news.
It is good news.
So I know that Johns Hopkins Hospital turns out great products because that's where I was born. So, I'm biased a little bit.
Must be.
True story. But what keeps you there? I mean, you could be in Canada somewhere, or you could be over in Europe. You could be anywhere. What keeps you here at Johns Hopkins?
So, you know, I've been at Hopkins since med school. I'm getting older. I've been here since 1989.
Right.
So we are going on, it's going to be 34 years. So there are a number of things. I think that if you just look sort of personally, there is something about being at the same place that makes it easy, right? I like the people I work with. I tend to talk to a lot of people, and anywhere I go in the hospital, I have colleagues and friends, and for me, that makes it a very nice working environment. I think that, so that's on a very personal, is that it's easy, right? If you've been somewhere for a long time.
Right, correct.
But I wouldn't be there if it weren't a place that I didn't feel was a great place to be. So, you know, I think that what I like about Hopkins and what I tell someone who's, let's say, interviewing at for Hopkins is, I do think we have a mission to have excellent patient care. Obviously, the research, education are part of the mission, but from a patient care standpoint, you know, I think that the average person at Johns Hopkins who's seeing patients really cares about their patients. They care about the community. They want better for health care of the individual and the community. There's a certain standard that, you know, I haven't been, as you probably say to me, well, but Derek, you've never been anywhere else, right? But, you know, I talk to patients who come from other places, other states, other hospitals, and we get a lot of positive feedback for the care we give them.
Right.
You know, I do think it has attracted over the years people who are ambitious, who want to be the best in their field. But I also feel, you know, and I don't know what other people's experiences are. You know, I'm an insider. But I do feel that people who don't get along with other people generally don't last that long. It doesn't encourage those type of
right.
people. And so
right.
it's a very collegial environment from a working standpoint. But you also feel that from a patient standpoint, we do a lot of good. We take care of everybody, right? We don't exclude anyone can come to our emergency room from anywhere in the world. And they're sick, we'll admit them, and we will take care of every patient in the same way, regardless of who they are. Now, are there implicit biases and we can go into whole those type of things? Like everywhere, they probably are. But
right.
I think at the basic level, there is a commitment to taking care of everyone as best you can, no matter who they are. And I think that is just something you feel. There's something about the culture that you feel that. And other places have tried to emulate that culture. You know, a lot of our trainees leave and they go somewhere and say, well, let me try and have the same sort of systems to, because it's a good system and it's just in the bones, right? There's just something about a place that's been doing this for 100 years. Now, you know, it's not a perfect place. There are many people out there who are probably going to say, well, Hopkins did this and did that. And here's some areas where they ethically did things wrong. You know, it has its warts for sure.
Right. Right.
Like any place does. But as a someone who works there, I feel like I'm doing good work. I'm serving my patients. I'm serving the community. I'm providing, you know, and I'm in an environment that cares and is collegial and also thoughtful.
It's something I wanted to ask you because your patient demographic is predominantly black. Am I right?
I would say it is. I mean, it is a good mix. But yes, I would say that predominantly black, but as far as the local population, yes.
As the culture goes, have you learned anything about yourself in dealing with black people that you didn't? I mean, what have you learned as long as you've been there at Hopkins about us as black people that you probably didn't know or that you could pass on to persons that are coming up under you that are physicians?
Wow, that's a complicated question. you know, I've learned if you just treat people with respect and you listen and you're aware that, you know, of your biases, if you have them, and you just do the best you can, that people really are receptive to that. But you could, you know, that's probably a generic answer, right? But there's a perception, right? Like how you engage people.
Right.
You know, I'm not scared of people that are different from me. I think you have to know that differences are okay. And, you know, I think you just, you know, I can't pinpoint it. You know, I think everyone, there's, you know, the black population is not homogeneous either, right?
Right, right.
You know, people who have drug issues, who, you know, really down and out, and they may have psychiatric issues, and I've got to deal with them very differently and from someone who's, you know, works for the government and is a lawyer, right? Like, there's no sort of recipe. But I think I say you address each person in their context, and you learn to understand that, you know, I think if you looked at me as an intern and someone came in and they were using drugs, I would be angry because I was tired and it was just another admission for me, right?
Right.
And now that I'm older and more mature and not more chilled, but just maybe a more empathetic person because I've seen a lot more, like I don't have that. I have a sadness more than an anger, right?
Right.
Not, I understand much more as I've gotten older that people don't choose where they are in life. You know, okay. They might make bad decisions, but I still need to take care of them and understand those decisions they've made, but not blame them for them. And, you know, they have an illness. You know, someone who drinks has an illness, they're not a bad person. And I think that's generic, right? It's not, you know, black or white.
Correct.
But certainly at Hopkins, there are still a lot of people who use drugs. And, you know, I'm sure if I went to a hospital where there was a predominantly white population, they also use drugs. There tends to be probably more opioids.
Right.
Than in my population, there's still a lot of cocaine and heroin, not as much methamphetamine. So it's going to obviously be very different. But I think I have a greater understanding and empathy than I probably had 30 years ago.
Makes sense. And what's interesting about you is you come at it from a very unique perspective. Having grown up during apartheid in Johannesburg in South Africa, you as a white man or a white young lad, you saw the way things were there as opposed to the way things are here, but blacks on both sides were still struggling here and there. Have you ever thought about going back to South Africa to practice to maybe, I don't know, help what's lacking as far as the black population over there?
You know, I've thought about it. I have not gone back. I mean, I've traveled back. I don't have any family there anymore.
Okay.
You know, and my kids are all born here. I do sometimes have guilt that I don't give more. I must admit that growing up, I probably had less empathy and regret that. And I think that, not to criticize parents because I have great parents, but I try for my own children to have them see the world through other people's eyes. That's something I think that I've learned more that I didn't.
Right.
I wish someone had done with me as a 10-year-old in South Africa instead of me living a blissful life of playing my sports and enjoying the good weather, right? That's what a 10-year-old does,
right?
Especially if you're privileged. And was not necessarily sat down by my parents and said, like, look around you. You know, my wife was. She grew up and she became a social worker and she has a, you know, tremendous insight into what was going on. And not that I don't now, but at the time I just wanted to go play cricket.
Right.
So, but I think as I've gotten older, I look back and I wish I'd known more. And now, you know, I try harder now to teach those that are under me to look and be more empathetic and really try to understand what's going on around them and being in other people's shoes and seeing it, how hard life can be for so many people. But I did not really, I guess I digressed, but I,
okay.
You know, I think from a career standpoint, the opportunities, I don't know if I could work in South Africa. I certainly go back and do some volunteer work, but I don't think I could ever live there.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's all growing up now and things have changed a lot, and that's great. Progression is a great thing. But I have seen you, I've seen firsthand how you get involved personally with some patients and you take great pride and you take great care of people outside of the hospital that need you. And that's always appreciated. And I just think it's amazing how you've come from where you've come from, how you've grown to where you are. And you still take just great care of your patients, no matter what the race or ethnicity. And
I do my best. I make mistakes, but I try, and I try to be available and personable. I think that helps. I think part of my problem is I talk too much, and then I come home late, and you know my day takes much longer. But at the end of the day, I think that gives me a lot of joy, and so you know I talk a lot to my patients and get to know them sort of personally sometimes.
Well, before I let you go, really quick, one of the things we didn't talk about was prevention. Provided someone does not have that gene that you spoke of, how can they prevent kidney disease best?
Right. So actually, whether you have the gene or not, and you know, you asked me earlier, and I didn't quite answer your question about symptoms. Because one doesn't have symptoms, it's really important to check blood pressure intermittently. Probably the biggest impact we can have up front is blood pressure control. So a lot of folks, for example, with these genetic predispositions tend to have high blood pressure at a really young age, and they don't know, you know, unless they're lucky enough to try and be recruited in the military, or, you know, where someone checks their pressure at 18 or 19 or 20. So I think that blood pressure screening is really crucial, and with that tight blood pressure control and management is really important. Not smoking. I still see too many smokers. Huge issue.
Okay.
For heart and kidneys, and heart and kidneys. Anything good for the heart is going to be good for the kidneys. So,
okay.
You know, that's sort of one of my mantras. Weight. Keeping a weight down. Exercise. It's amazing how much impact weight loss has on just general health, but certainly blood pressure and kidney health. Diabetes, screening sugar, if someone's urinating more than they should be, get checked out for things like diabetes or other kidney issues. But if someone has diabetes, to be really meticulous in controlling their diabetes. And then there are now some drugs that I don't think I've got through a Ravens game without seeing a commercial for a drug called Farxiga.
Yes.
And, you know, often these commercials are hype. I must say that this Farxiga drug, for those who go on it, it does have really significant impact in their long-term kidney outcome. So in someone who has chronic kidney disease, being on a drug in that family of drugs is really beneficial, together with what are called ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers, which are blood pressure medicines. So the two together have significant impact in slowing down progression of kidney disease. The problem with the Farxiga and its the drugs similar to it is they do have very high copays. But there are ways to get these drugs through the company where that cost can be mitigated. So there are medicines, but I think prevention is really more important, and that involves diet, you know, keeping the weight down. You know, even if you're eating unhealthy, which isn't ideal, the problem is eating unhealthy generally results in weight gain, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, people can keep their weights down, exercise, monitor their blood pressure, you know, make sure that, you know, they don't have diabetes, you know, get to a doctor intermittently. I think that you can really have a significant impact, but you have to get it in early, and that's why and getting blood testing
so important
will identify the disease.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's no rash that says I've got kidney disease, and so you just got to do these things, and they've all had impact, and the more of these interventions, the better people do.
Okay. Well, listen, the half hour has gone by incredibly fast. I appreciate you so much, Derek, for coming on today. And now you are officially a member of 1500 Radio. My audience will certainly take the nuggets that you've dropped today and hopefully put them to use. And thank you so much for being here with me.
Thanks so much. Thanks for the conversation.
All right, Derek. Thank you so much. Hey, listen, enjoy your day. And too bad about the Ravens, but, you know, it is what it is.
You win some, you lose some.
There you go. All right, Dr. Fine, you take care of yourself. All right, I know you hear the music. You know what time that is. It is time for The Petty. He is here today, and he's going to give us a rundown on what the playoff picture has shaped up to be, who's left in the playoff, who might be moving forward, and who is going to be left packing to go home or stay home. Let's find out. Let's get The Petty on the line.
Brother B, how are you?
I'm good. It is The Petty. It is The Petty today. How you feeling, man?
I'm feeling just great on this divisional rounds today. I'm telling you, we got some good ones today. But you know what? Before we get into today's games, I want to talk about what happened last week on Super Wild Card Weekend. And let me tell you something. It was super.
Yeah,
the games were fantastic.
Good games.
But it's two games I'm not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about the game that involved the Cowboys, and I'm not even going to talk about the game that involved the 49ers.
Why?
I'm going to talk about the first game. I'm going to talk about the first game that I predicted that the Giants would go into Minnesota and beat those Vikings.
They did. I mean, you were right.
All year long, I was not believing Captain Kirk, and it showed last weekend.
You know, it's just that what's weird is the Vikings started struggling at the wrong time, and the Giants started playing well at the right time. So
exactly.
You know, and that's all it is.
And that's what it's supposed to be going in. That's how it has to be going into the playoffs, because you got to get hot at the right time. You can't have a fall off. Now, let's talk about that Miami-Buffalo game. Man, that was tight. And you know what? I think Miami could have pulled off the upset, except for one thing. Poor clock management.
Wow.
I mean, I had memories of Andy Reid right there. Poor clock management. I think they may have been able to pull off an upset. And talking about upsets, an upset that everybody in Baltimore should have been looking forward to was that the Ravens had the Bengals. They had them, and they let them off the hook. I don't understand what their clock management was all about, and I don't understand that play call with Tyler Huntley. Why is he jumping in the air?
Yeah.
What is that all about? I mean, but then again, that's typical Ravens.
No, it's not typical Ravens.
Yeah, it's typical Ravens. They do bonehead stuff, and that was a bonehead play.
I was annoyed, man. You have no idea how annoyed. I was yelling at my screen, bro. I don't usually do that, man, but I was so upset.
I'm telling you, I'm not a big Raven fan, but I was upset just watching that play unfold, because they had them. They had the Bengals beat.
Yeah, they did.
And that play right there, the momentum shifted.
Completely shifted.
They weren't able to recover. So that just threw me. It really did. So when I think about those games right there. Oh, and how can I forget about Dougie P and those spotted cats down in Jacksonville turning it around against the Chargers? And I'm telling you right now, I don't see how that head coach still has a job. You're up 27-0 in a playoff game. When you lose, you don't get to say, well, you know what, guys, we'll get them next week. You lose, you go home.
No, you're right.
That was big collapse. Again, Brandon Staley should be out of the NFL.
I agree. 100%. He won't be, but I agree.
Yeah, well, they're going to keep him on for another year, and hopefully next year will be his last year. But you know what? Let's move right along to today's game, because we already know what happened yesterday, and those two teams are waiting to see who their opponents will be next week for the conference championship games. So, first game up, those Strike Tigers, those Bengals will be going up to Buffalo to play those Buffalo Bills. Now, this is the continuation of the game that was halted on Monday night with the DeMar Hamlin situation. And during that time, the Bengals were leading the Bills. And then that tragedy struck.
Yeah, but this is an emotional game for the Bills in particular. So, and they're going to be in Buffalo. So,
yes. And the Bengals are missing three starters on their offensive line. And Joe Burrow's already been sacked numerous times. So with that being said, I'm going to take the Bills in a close one.
Whoa, okay. All right.
I like the Bengals. I think they want to get back to the Super Bowl, but I just don't think they have enough. Like I said, it's going to be an emotional game for Buffalo. And I think they're going to come out like they did last week. And I think they're going to limit their turnovers and their mistakes. And it's going to be a well-played game.
You think Hamlin will actually be at the game? You think DeMar Hamlin will actually be at the game?
I think he will be at the game.
Yeah,
and it's going to be emotional for both teams, because it was a Bills member, but it happened on Cincinnati's field.
Yep.
So that's something. And then tomorrow night, man, oh, man, you know I'm excited about this one. This is an old NFC rivalry, an old NFC playoff rivalry that goes back to the 80s, especially the 90s. And I'm talking about them boys from the Big D going to the Golden Gate City to play the 49ers.
Yeah. The Cowboys don't stand a chance, bro.
You know what? If Dak plays a clean game, they have the chance to beat the 49ers. See, I like the 49ers because I like the 49ers. But their defense and all the weapons that they have on offense, can Dallas withstand that? On the same token, can San Francisco handle that offense with CeeDee Lamb? And if Dak is hot, and you got to worry about Joey Gallup and you got to worry about Zeke coming out the back. And I really like Michael Pollard better than I like Zeke, but Dallas is not a bad team.
But isn't Pollard hurt?
He'll play tomorrow. That's for sure.
All right.
But I think it really is going to come down to the coaching, because I think Kyle Shanahan has shown that he can plug anybody into that quarterback position and make that offense work.
Right.
So in a close one, and if it gets down to a field goal, you better take the Niners, because you saw what happened with Dallas' field goal kicker last week.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised he still has a job.
Yeah. Well, you know I don't like Dallas, but I got to call, like I said, they're a very talented team. It's easy for me to say that they could possibly be playing next week in the NFC Championship game, but I'm going to go with those Golden Gate guys. I got to go with the Niners.
I knew that you would.
You know I was. There has been a time I went against them, but this time, that young boy, Brock Purdy, Purdy, is doing his thing. He's not playing like a rookie. Yes, he makes some mistakes. Yes, he looks a little scared at times, but then something like a light switch goes on, and he just turns it on. He looks like a cagey veteran, making certain moves, scrambling out of the pocket, finding the receiver that's going to make things happen for him. I like that young man, and it would be a tragedy if he's not the starter for the 49ers next year.
I agree 100%.
So with that being said, Brother B, next week, AFC, NFC Championship round, we will be talking about that, because I have a feeling the winner of today's games may just meet up in the Super Bowl.
Is that right?
And if that's so, you know where you heard it first, Brother B. And I hope your listeners were listening last week, and I called that Giants-Vikings game, because they would have made a whole lot of money.
Hey, let me ask you a question before you roll up out of here. You know I got to ask you what you've learned about Lamar. You know?
I heard a little something on Friday, Brother B, where the management and the coaching staff and anybody in that Ravens building is saying that they are 200% sure that they will get their deal done and Lamar will be a Raven.
Really?
Next year. Now, what you see and what you hear, two different things, Brother B. Now, what I heard is that he'll be a Raven next year. They'll get the deal done and he will be there for years to come.
Where are they going
to
find the money from?
That's a good question. But this is what I see. Lamar's hurt. I get it. I understand it. He can't play. He put a statement out there that if he's not 100%, he don't want to be on the field because he thought he'd be hurting his team. And I can respect that. But why didn't you travel with the team?
That's the thing. That spoke volumes to many, many people.
Yes, and it spoke volumes to me also. So what you're seeing, what you hear, two different things.
Yeah, well,
so that's to be continued, Brother B. And speaking of continuing, keep on continuing to do your job, because you're doing a wonderful job. And I look forward to our phone call next weekend.
Well, you know you're going to get it, bro. God willing, you're going to definitely get it. So I appreciate you coming on today, taking out the time, and we will definitely talk to you next week.
Peace, Brother B.
Peace, brother. Out. And just like that, we've come to the end of another episode of On the Weekend Edition. Look, the hour continues to go by at an incredibly fast rate for me, the fastest hour of the week for me. And it's because I enjoy being here with you and doing what I do. But remember what Dr. Derek said, preventing kidney disease, it starts with us. It's much easier to prevent it than it is to manage it, live with it, or get a transplant. So eat your fruits and your vegetables. I know we tell our kids that is good for them, but you know what? It's great for us as well. It is not a double standard situation. We have to eat our fruits and vegetables also. We have to exercise, at least walk once a day. Do that. You don't have to run the stairs or the hills or run at all, but make sure you get your walk in, that you're not just sitting sedentary on the couch watching TV, feeding your face full of chips and cakes. That's not going to help you. It's going to kill you. Smoking, cut it out. It's never been good for you, so don't do it. Also, water intake. You know, the kidneys are a filtration device for your body. Make sure that filter stays clean and drink lots of water. Go see your doctor. And I'm talking to black men in particular when I say this, because we have a habit of not going to the doctor. Let us go to the doctor. And the older we get, the more important it becomes. Go to the doctor, get your blood work checked. Make sure your blood pressure is good. You don't want to be walking around here and then all of a sudden drop dead and explode because you were too stubborn or too busy to take care of yourself and get it checked out. There are literally men driving around right now in $100,000 cars. They get their oil changed religiously every 5,000 miles, but haven't been to the doctor themselves in 5 years. Bro, it doesn't matter how good the car is or how nice it looks or how much it costs if you can't drive it. Drive your ass to the doctor, get checked out under your hood, and then you're good to go. The bottom line is we could be around living healthier for a much longer time if we take care of ourselves. That is basically what Dr. Fine was trying to tell us today. It's really as simple as that. Also, I want to thank DePetty for coming on today. And remember what he said. He said, Dallas is going down. They're at the end of their rope. They're going to lose to the 49ers. And he also said that the Bills were going to beat the Bengals. So I'm going to trust him on that. They sound like good picks to me. I'm going to take him up on that and see if I make some money. Next week is a big show. I'm very excited. I've got Grammy Award-winning saxophonist Kirk Whalum coming on to the show. I'm going to dig into his life and find out how he feels about what he's done in his career and what he's doing right now. He had close ties to Whitney Houston, and I'm going to talk to him about that relationship. Also, I want to talk to DePetty again and see what we've got coming up into the Super Bowl. So listen, enjoy your Sunday. Have a great time today. Relax. Do nothing. Wake up tomorrow morning and conquer the world, because like I said, the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. And please remember to get at me on IG at On with Brian Pettaway. Let me know what you thought about the show today. Let me know if you have any questions, if you need any information on anything that we discussed today. And please tell me if there are any topics that you want me to tackle, because I certainly will. All right, people, I got to get out of here. Enjoy the games today. Peace.